So, I'm going to talk about scale invariance also, which was mentioned by one of the previous speakers here. Scale invariance in this talk is not going to be a global scale invariance, so general relativity is invariant on the global scale transformations. This talk is going to be about, or following, or very much inspired by, an idea by Hermann Weyl from 1918. He objected to Einstein's general relativity that his point was that we should basically require the theory to be invariant on the local rescalings. So this is a suicide topic from an academic point of view because it's very hard. But those are the types of fields I like to dig into. It's a suicide field because, first of all, the originator of this kind of theory, Hermann Weyl, is dead. And secondly, he gave up on this idea. So,
any correlation between his death and...
What?
Is there any correlation between his death and giving up?
Might be. So this is the outline. First, I'm going to sort of give an introduction to Weyl's idea from basic epistemology, which is length measurements. Then I'm going to sort of show the mathematical implementation of the theory. And then I'm going to give further motivations why we would like a scale invariant theory. Then, of course, there was probably some rivalry between Einstein and Weyl. So they had this fruitful discussion and confrontation. So Einstein raised three distinct objections against Weyl's theory, which is locally scale invariant. And the first is that this is the size of hydrogen atoms. Weyl's theory predicts that you would have different sizes of hydrogen atoms depending on how they go through an electromagnetic field. You don't observe that. Second is that how do you account for proper time in this theory is sort of non-trivial. The third one is Weyl's actions, the ones he wrote down, leads to fourth order field equations. And it is known that this gives rise to instabilities, dynamical instabilities. So that's a sort of a serious sort of shortcoming. So in this talk, I'm going to first outline how to solve these two first objections. The first one can be answered by saying that the Weyl field is not the electromagnetic field. The second one, you have to provide a physical model of clocks, and then you get a notion of the proper time in this theory, which agrees with general relativity in a limit. Then there's the big task of tackling the third objection, which is coming up with field equations, which is our second order in time and not fourth order in time. I'm going to add more meat to it, because scale invariance is a very, very subtle topic. So I'm going to add more criteria in the end here, what we mean by scale invariance, or what I would like to mean with scale invariance. It's been known by that invariance can be achieved in a trivial way. Kretschmann was one of the first ones to point this out. And one has to avoid trivial invariance properties of a theory. This is also a rather speculative talk. There's a lot more work to be done, and attacking this problem of scale invariance brings me into all different kinds of, it's quantum field theory, renormalization, symmetry breaking, and so on. So here's also a disclaimer. This is my presentation of Weyl's and Einstein's arguments. They're slightly modified as to have to write a good narrative on this talk, so just keep that in mind. So let us begin. In order to understand the context, let me first just outline how you can think of general relativity as a gauge theory of rotations and boosts. So if you look here, here's a parallel transport of a vector. This is given by the parallel transport equation. This is just the ordinary derivative and plus this connection here. Now, this connection here is it's not a clean object. It's, you can think of it as an infinitesimal general linear transformation. But that's due to that you have a non an oblique coordinate system you're working with, or an oblique basis vectors. Now, Elie Cartan is at that why it's nicer to do general relativity in an orthonormal frame. And if you do that, you get the same connection but rewritten in an orthonormal frame. And then you see the true significance of the connection. This is just an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. That is, it's a rotation and a boost. So what happens when you parallel transport an object is that it's a sequence of boosts and rotations. So the effect of gravity is nothing but a succession of infinitesimal boosts and rotations. And you can understand the free fall and everything from that concept. So here's an important thing. Parallel transport preserves angles and lengths. So if you would have sort of a ruler, and if you move it parallel transport, you find it that the angle between the two rulers are always the same. And it's of course in this way you cannot locally observe the gravitational field. Not only angles are preserved in general relativity, lengths are preserved. So the ruler would have the same length. So if you now have a guy here, you parallel transport the guy here, you'll find that he's going to get rotated and boosted. But if you have his leg here, the length of the leg is going to be the same, and the angle between his legs is going to be the same. And this is sort of how gravity works on the system. And so the equivalence principle in this constant is that all physical system gets acted upon by the same boost and the same rotation. So let's now turn to Weyl's objection to general relativity. He started from the following idea. Consider now a measurement of length. So here you have two big rulers. A measurement of length is always done with a reference ruler. So suppose this is your reference ruler now. The measuring this big object here is done by laying out this reference ruler and see how many reference ruler you can put alongside it. But then you see that the outcome of this measurement, well, first of all, the length here is a ratio, so it's dimensionless. And secondly, you see that if you rescale the whole thing here, so here's the same version of these two rules, but smaller, you see that the outcome is exactly the same. So Weyl was arguing then that from an epistemological point of view, you cannot measure absolute length or intrinsic length in an object. You always measure ratios, and ratios are invariant under scale transformations, even local scale transformations. So Weyl's idea was then that no, you should not use sort of the connection we have in general relativity, which preserves angles and lengths. You should weaken that. You should say it should only preserve angles and ratios of lengths. So if you do that, you should require that this the parallel transport of this object, and you see this is the angle between U1 and U2, only that should be zero. So if you do that, you find that you get a generalization of Riemannian geometry. Normally, the covariant derivative of the metric is zero, but now you find there's a more general situation where the covariant derivative is not zero, but equal to some new one-form field here. This is called the Weyl field. So, okay, let's see the physical effect of this field on objects. So let's take a sort of a trivial or a simple mathematical representation of a ruler, just as a vector. And then if you work this out, just see what the parallel transport with this new theory does an object with such a Weyl field in it, you see that it basically rescales. So let me just point to the picture here. If you take a ruler, which is the blue object here, you move it along one trajectory, and you also consider moving it along a different trajectory here. You find that not only can you get different directions of the vectors, you can also get different lengths. So this is the most general situation that can happen here. But most importantly, you see that this Weyl field CAA actually rescales objects. If you have a strong Weyl field there, you take a ruler and you would move it through it, it would shrink it or make it larger. And then you have this sort of curvature of this vial field also, that if you move a ruler along one trajectory, if you move it along a different trajectory, you can get two different sizes of it. So Weyl was very, very excited about this idea, because when you look at the math of this, it looks like, well, here's a conformal transformation of the metric, which is a rescaling. It's just rescales your distance locally. So this theta is a position-dependent entity here. Now, this Weyl field undergoes a similar transformation also. And that's exactly how the electromagnetic field would transform like. So Weyl was very, very intrigued by this and said this is a unification between electromagnetism and gravity. And Einstein agreed this is a stroke of genius of first rank. However, this is a mistake. This we know now. This cannot be the electromagnetic field. First of all, an electromagnetic field discriminates between positively charged particles and negatively charged particles. But by assumption above, maybe I didn't state it carefully. So the assumption that goes into this epistemological argument is that the rescaling acts universally on all physical fields. You couldn't see it locally. So this is the first indication there's something wrong. Then there's also a mathematical indication that if you look at the sort of the gauge group manifold, the rescaling has R plus as its gauge group manifold, but the electromagnetic field has U1. So there's a mismatch here. So for example, for electromagnetism, perhaps coupled to some Dirac field, you see that e to the I theta plus 2 pi is equal to EI theta. So you sort of identify this point, with itself. But the rescaling doesn't have this structure at all. Without the I here now, e to the theta plus 2 pi is not equal to e to the theta, of course. So there's a big mismatch there. So now I just present a sort of an epistemological argument for scale invariance, that measurement of length is a relational concept. It's the ratio. Now let me add two more arguments. So if you look at the standard model, it's almost scale invariant as it is written down. So let me just go here. So this is from Mandel and Shaw's book. This is the electroweak theory. If you look in all those terms here now, I mean the standard model will have even more terms. They're all gauge. Locally scale invariant, except this term here, which is the Higgs mass term. And now, if you would add also a gravity term to this, you see that the only two terms that break local scale invariance in the standard model is the Higgs mass term here and the gravity term. That's the only two terms that break it. Now, the second one is that if you look at singularities, how singularities emerge in general relativity, and that we like to get rid of singularities, it's because the expansion blows up. This is what the singularity theorems establish. So this expansion goes to minus infinity. So if you promote scale to a gauge variable, and so also expansion, then you see that you couldn't get any singularity theorems because that's a gauge variable. And the theory doesn't predict anything about the gauge variable. So by making a theory locally scale invariant, you would also get out of these singularity theorems. Maybe you like singularities and this would be a bad thing, but if you don't like singularities, scale invariance might resolve such things. You can also rewrite the ADM action in terms of kinematical invariance. Here's a conformal invariant term, which is the shearing. It's sort of how space-time is shearing against itself like this. This is a kinetic term. And then the expansion term, which is how much volume is produced per unit time, that comes in with a negative sign. That's the reason you get this kind of in unstable singularity producing behaviors in GR. So let me now get to Einstein's three objections. It's hydrogen spectrum, no account for proper time, and fourth order field equations. So here's the first thing. So I assume now that the Weyl field is just an electric field, which is what Weyl and Einstein thought. Then if you would take a hydrogen atom here now and move it along a trajectory, we would have this Weyl rescaling effect. So if you moved along this trajectory here, and if you move it along that trajectory, you could have two different sizes of the hydrogen atom. Now, a hydrogen atom with two different sizes would give off radiation of two different frequencies. So you would see that this theory would predict that the hydrogen spectrum wouldn't be so sharp as it is now. We don't see sort of we see one frequency from hydrogen atoms, and so this is not observed experimentally. So the theory is falsified in this way. But as we already pointed out before, this Weyl field cannot be the electromagnetic field anyway. So this whole setup of this objection is wrong. But the effect would still be there, that if you had a Weyl field and you move this hydrogen atom along one trajectory and a different trajectory, you could get different sizes. But now, since it's a new field, you wouldn't know its physical or its typical field strength. So now you can avoid objection by saying, oh, the effect is small, and that's it. Because with electric field, we know its typical field strength. We can manipulate it in the lab and so on. But now, all we have to say now is that apparently this Weyl field strength is very, very small. Proper time. So this is the issue with proper time. The ordinary expression for proper time is given by GAB, DXA, DXB. But that's a gauge-dependent object in this theory now. Because if we make such a gauge transformation, we see that the proper time we start with over here actually get rescaled. So now is the question, now if you move along some definite trajectory, what will the clock show? Will it show tau or tau twiddle? And of course nature will, the clock's gonna show something definite in reality. And this theory is unable to say if it's gonna be tau or tau twiddle. There's something wrong here. So Weyl had first a desperate proposal by multiplying the tau by the Ricci scalar. But that's desperate because what if you are in flat space-time now? R could be zero. So then the proper time is zero. The second one, Weyl said, well, we have to develop a physical model for a clock. And then he said that, and he never did it. That's sort of where things were left. So one of the things I started saying, okay, I need to model a clock. And it was Lucien Hardy who suggested to me that, well, why don't we just look at a light clock? And so this is exactly what I started doing. So a light clock is just a cylinder with a photon inside it, bouncing back and forth like this. And on one side here, there's a photon counter. And so in the space-time picture, you would just have photon going here, boom, 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 and you get sort of a counting. So how to move this light clock now? Well, you like to move it in such a way that you're not torquing or stretching your light clock. That is just given by the parallel transport, but now with sort of a Weyl connection in it, which is non-metrical. So if you just do the calculation, I won't go through it here, you find out that the length of the ruler will of course be rescaled, like this, and I shouldn't spend too much time because it's already stuff to talk.
What's in the box?
Which box? Yeah, so basically, you can argue from this picture here by just looking at a limit as the as this, the photon, what the light clock gets smaller and smaller, that d mu, which is the what you can call it the Weyl proper time or Weyl period proper time, should be just d tau over s, where s is the size, which you can derive an expression from here, and d tau is the ordinary proper time given by the metric, which didn't work about, but this comes in here. So if you just plug it in here, you see that the light clock, what it shows is mu here, is given by this expression. So the reason I call it Weyl Perlik time is because Volker Perlik discovered this same expression in the 70s when he was looking at a definition of a privileged parameter by orthogonality of four velocity and four acceleration. So the thing is that you get a unique expression in this theory for proper time, how much a clock will show along the trajectory. What is interesting about this is that it contains the ordinary proper time here, which is this thing here, and it also contains a prefactor, which is path dependent. And that's exactly what you would expect in this theory. If you move a light clock along one path or another path, the size of the light clock will be different. But if the size of the light clock is different, then the rate of ticking will be different also. This is called the second clock effect. Let me see if I... So if you move the light clock along here, or a different trajectory, the rate of... not only will the clock show differently, but the rate of ticking will be different also. So that's just comes out like that. Also, I've done calculations in GR, maximizing the proper time gives the geodesics. The same doesn't appear to be true here. If you maximize the Weyl Perlik time, that's not going to give you the geodesics of the theory. So this is something that sort of coincidence only happened for GR. Apparently, it's very messy field equations, or messy equations for the when you vary this Weyl proper time. So let me now try to get to the last objection of Einstein. You can phrase the objection in this way, that I have found no strong mathematical proofs here. Maybe I'm not enough knowledgeable of the literature, but I've also asked some experts and so. But apparently, there are no actions which are seriously conformally invariant. I'll say a little bit more what I mean by that. Foliation invariant and yield second order field equations. And then, if this is the case, yeah?
What about the action of Einstein Hilbert with Weyl square?
Yeah, so.
It has second order, but it's unstable.
It's unstable, yeah. So that action you can get by conformalizing. Just Einstein Hilbert action. So let me go to that. So here's the suggestion now, and some may not like this. I'm saying, okay, how to get around this objection? Well, we have to give up foliation invariance. That will give us an extra degree of freedom to play around with, and we're going to have more actions we can play with. So the idea is now, give up foliation invariance, we introduce a preferred time, and then we kill the extra degree of freedom by imposing conformally invariance. So in the end, the theory will have effectively the same degrees of freedom as GR. You introduce a preferred time that adds a degree of freedom, you kill it off with a conformal transformation, which takes away a degree of freedom. So I wrote down, in a weird form, a family of actions. It's called the best matching form. This is sort of Julian Barbour's way of writing down actions. And it's very, very well suited for this kind of scale invariance here. So it was very easy to write down a large family of actions which are has a preferred time, are scale invariant, and gives first order field equation in time. So it avoids this Ostrogradsky, or it avoids this third objection of Einstein. So I collaborated with Tom Slosnick at the PI, and he showed also how you can rewrite these actions in a standard form. These guys here have square root actions, and they're sort of nasty to work with, and in the end, it's just nasty to work with those. So, of course, when you just write down a family of actions like this, I mean, are you sure you're going to get GR in some limit? So that's the drawback now. And it's very nasty to work with this type of actions to see what you get. So this is what I will try to address now. I need to make sure I get GR back in some limit. So let me add some reasons, because many people are very uncomfortable with giving up foliation invariance or the relativity of simultaneity, because that's supposed to be one of the grand sort of interesting developments of modern physics. So first of all, it is the foliation invariance that gives rise to the infamous problem of time, which includes the damned Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So this is a bit longer story, but you get this weird thing that the wave function is completely static, and the real and imaginary part of the wave function are uncoupled. So it's a very weird equation, and DeWitt himself, I think, didn't like it at all. He called it a damned equation. So that's one reason to try to avoid having a foliation invariant theory, because it seems to give rise to bad quantum theories when you quantize it with Dirac quantization. Second thing is that if you break Lorentz invariance, and if you have more spatial derivatives than time derivatives, that improves power counting renormalizability. So that could be a good thing for GR, which is, as it is, not renormalizable. Here's a third objection. It's known that you cannot construct a conformally invariant theory, which is generally covariant, that doesn't have a conformal anomaly. A conformal anomaly is the following. Your classical equations are conformally invariant, but when you quantize, the quantization procedure destroys conformal invariance. So here it's suggestive also that you shouldn't stick with general covariance, because if you do that, all your efforts trying to construct conformally invariant theory will be destroyed when you quantize it. Of course, many of you would say, what about Lorentz invariance? If you put in an absolute time now, what about Lorentz invariance? And you're going to destroy all the predictions of special relativity and all the bounds we have on Lorentz invariance. Yeah, this looks like a big problem, but it's not. It's just a restriction how you couple your theories to gravity. In fact, what is Lorentz invariance? Lorentz invariance is when you restrict yourself to region in spacetime which is flat, so it doesn't have any gravitational excitations, so to speak. And then you look at the matter field equations in there. And now, if I write down an action like this, so the matter fields couple in an ordinary way to gravity. And you can see on this, if I would write out these expressions, this would not couple to the preferred foliation itself. Then you see that if you restrict yourself to a region which is flat, you feel the equations are Lorentz invariant. So it's only the gravitational sector here, this L vial, that would feel this preferred time. So the issue here is that, no, you don't have an immediate problem with Lorentz invariance. So this is sort of a bit of a conceptual interesting thing. You can have a preferred simultaneity and Lorentz invariance at the same time. It's not an immediate problem. You should also make sure that your gravitational propagates on the light cone. This has to be imposed also. That's horrendous calculations. How much time do I have left now?
10 minutes, including questions.
Including questions. Okay, yeah. So let me now just cite some mathematical criteria for scale invariance. Like Kretschmann was pointing out to Einstein in, was it 1916 or something like that, symmetries can be trivial. You can take any theory, you make a symmetry transformation of it, and you're going to get new types of variables in the theory, and then the theory looks like it's invariant under that new symmetry group. You can apply that. For example, you can take the Kleinboden equation, make a general coordinate transformation, you get extra coordinate fields in the theory, and it looks like it's diffeomorphism invariant. But of course, that's not the serious diffeomorphism invariant theory. And the same thing you can do to here, you can just start with general relativity. You just make an arbitrary conformal transformation with the phi here. And then you say, well, I started with Einstein-Hilbert action, I get this new theory, which is just conformalizing the action. It contains G and sort of a scale field here. But of course, we have done nothing here. This is just conformal makeup on it. This is the same theory as before. So we haven't changed anything, and we haven't achieved serious conformal invariance. So we have to impose that any seriously scale invariant theory should not contain any scale fields that picks up a preferred length scale, like this phi up here. Furthermore, scale invariant theory should not contain constant that determines a preferred length scale. So that's also very important, and that's what's making this project really, really hard now. Because now, if you look at the constants you have in the standard model, which gives you a length scale, it's basically the cosmological constant, Planck scale, and Higgs scale. Now, all of these constants, which gives you a preferred length scale, those cannot be, they cannot exist in a seriously conformally invariant theory. So, of course, everybody is used to talk about the Planck scale. Well, in a seriously conformally invariant theory, you cannot have a Planck scale. There cannot be a minimum unit of length. Because if there is, I mean, the theory cannot really be called scale invariant. There's this block, this absolute unit there. So, the project, I think I lost this one. Well, let me just try to speak up. So the project here is, I need to try to eliminate all these fundamental constants we have in nature. There are rather few, there's only three of them in fact. There's the cosmological, Planck, and Higgs scale. So let me outline now as the last thing I do. Way to eliminate all three constants. And this is very speculative, there's a lot more, and this is probably wrong in the end. Because I haven't checked, and that's how things tend to be, right? But this is sort of an outline. Yeah, thanks. This is sort of an outline of what I want to try to do. So, if you look at the cosmological constant and you write it down using a preferred vector field like this, you see it looks like a negative energy. But energy is usually varying in space. So here's the first idea. What we think of the cosmological constant, it's not really a constant. It is the energy of the gravitational field. So the idea now is that the cosmological constant, which is the energy, is made constant by imposing a conformal gauge. So if you now would go back to the ungauged fixed theory, you have to unconformalize GR basically. So if you do that, you find that you get a term like this, and this is a particular example of the family of scale invariant actions I showed before. You get some other terms, and this is really a nasty calculation. This has to go away, these terms here. It looks like I can get rid of these guys. They should actually be zero for proportional to a divergence given the conformals constraint and the energy conservation. That requires a lot more explanation. So if we disregard this nasty terms now and think it's zero, I'm cheating here, I have to show it's zero, I haven't done that yet, you see that you get second order field equations, it reproduces GR if you put the vial field strength to zero, so there's this curvature of the vial field that has to be zero, and if it's zero, you can see that this action reproduces GR. And it's also this an example of this type of actions I wrote down before. The second thing that happens now, well, the first thing is that we have actually eliminated the cosmological constant. There is no cosmological constant anymore here. There's a lambda here, but if you would include matter terms here now, you see that the only combination of constants is this guy, it's the G bar always coming here. G bar is lambda times the Newtonian gravitational constant G. G never occurs alone, and lambda never occurs alone. They're combined into a new constant, which I call G bar here. And here's the magical thing that happens here. Instead of having G, H bar, and C, we have now a G bar, H bar, and C. And if you now ask, can I form a Planck length from that? And the answer is no. So by this conformalization trick of identifying lambdas and energy, what I outlined above, we get rid of the cosmological constant, and we get rid of Planck length at the same time. So the last thing, I have a few minutes, no. Yeah, maybe that's it. No questions. It's too speculative for questions anyway, so. Another version of Einstein's argument here is that if nature is truly scale invariant, why is it that all hydrogen atoms have the same size? So if you think about rotational symmetry in nature, you say, well, there's no preferred directions, right? So if we throw out some rulers, or objects with some orientation to them, you'd find all these identical objects with different directions in space. We call this rotational invariance. And it would be very weird if all objects had to point in one direction, and nobody would call that a sort of a rotation invariant theory. But apparently, that similar thing happens for scale. We have a sequence of identical objects, and what we see is that they all have the same scale. Why isn't that we have football-sized hydrogen atoms and Planck scale or whatever hydrogen atoms? Why is it that they all have the same size? So this you can view as a version of Einstein's first objection. And probably here you need to address this with symmetry breaking somehow. That just as you can get preferred directions when the temperature is low, you can get preferred scales of things at low energies. So now I'm going to throw out the ridiculous idea, too speculative to be taken seriously. And again, in the standard model, you have to have this Higgs field. So now, if you look at this Mexican hat potential, it contains this nasty Higgs mass term here, which is not allowed by conformal invariance. It shouldn't be there, because if you have a Higgs mass, that gives you a length scale. You can play with C and H bar and get the length from that. So it shouldn't be there. Now, this is the ordinary Higgs Lagrangian. That's also not scale invariant. Here comes this intriguing part, which is pure speculation on my part. If you now make it scale invariant, so you include this vial field in it, so you replace these ordinary GR covariant derivatives with a vial covariant derivative, which includes this vial field, you see, if you just work it out, that you get a mass term here, which is the C squared, this vial field squared. So here's the bold proposition. The Higgs mass is the vial field squared. And maybe I should just end there, and no questions, please.